That time again, it is Hey Kids Comics time. This is issue, and this is freaky. This is freaky to say. This is issue 149. We are one issue away.
I'm seriously, like, freaking out here. And I'm not just saying that. I'm having a bit of a mini freak out here, man.
I'm having a freak out, man.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. We've almost done 150 issues of Hey Kids Comics. From some weird idea that we had a long, long time ago. Feels like forever ago. Now we're at 150. Thank you, everybody, for listening to 150 issues of us ramble on about comics, and we aren't going to stop anytime in the near future. You have my word on that.
Yes, indeed.
And to prove our point...
We're actually already planning issue 300.
Right. It's already in the works.
The retroactive issue 0 plus the...
negative
protoactive issue 1000.
Well, we're gonna have that negative one issue.
Oh, that's true.
Where we find out that our parents were secretly.
We have a research lab. I guess it's a little premature. We're gonna say this for 150, but I can't hold this back. We are working on trying to find a bag an issue.
Oh, are we?
Yeah, I've got people researching how to. Put audio into, like, Mystic Mylar or something.
It is some sort of poly bag and get it graded? Can we get that graded?
You know my stand on grading.
I do. But you'll just have to download two issues, one graded and one not, so you can listen to it.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you have a choice.
So you could slab an issue of Hey Kids Comics. So, to prove our point that we're willing to continue to ramble aimlessly about comic books, tonight we bring you a very special edition of Hey Kids Comics. This was an idea of... Oh, I'm Andrew Farmer, by the way, over there. That's Cole Houston, the Jedi Cole.
Good evening. Yes, I am here. I am actually clothed in Mylar.
Clothed.
I'm cloaked and clothed in Mylar.
You're cloaked.
I basically took an iron and ironed a bunch of, like, comic bags together to make myself a robe.
I think Cloaked in Mylar is the name of Ultron Cafe's next album.
It actually is. It's their next album. It's due out in October. I'm really thrilled because it's coming out on my birthday.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome because my birthday's on a Monday, and normally stuff gets released on Tuesday. But, you know, that's Ultron Cafe for
and they,
you.
They buck the system. There is no system.
They actually argue that it's Tuesday somewhere.
They're the only person. They're the only group of people that's ever argued that it's Tuesday somewhere. So, yes, new issue tonight. This was Cole's initiative, and I fully support it. So I'm going to let Cole explain what we're doing tonight. This is, like I said, 149. So, Cole, take it away a little bit, will you?
Well, basically, what I had in mind here is in the past, and I just... only now occurred to me maybe I could have looked to see when we did this. But we have talked in the past about the relationships that superheroes have. We talked about love and the superhero and love, Justice League style, things like that. I don't even know where that came from.
I don't know what that was. I love it. Keep it up.
That's old people sitcom.
This is the energy that we need to have tonight, so keep going.
So anyway... basically, the idea was, we've talked about the superhero dating, superheroes having girlfriends or dating each other, et cetera, but it occurred to me we really never touched on the fully. I thought we should really fully explore the idea of being a normal person who falls for a superhero, who gets, that normal Joe or Jane on the street who somehow... like these 50 celebrities who have hideous spouses type of thing.
Yes.
On Facebook or something. And same idea where, you wonder how to, it's like in Pulp Fiction, how are people meet people?
How are people meeting people?
So how is it that you wind up meeting and finding a superhero, you know, or a superheroine?
Yes.
What is the dynamic of that kind of, you know, you think long distance relationships are tough. Casey, I'm in a long distance relationship. I did it again. That's our second time we've invoked.
We've invoked the long distance, the long distance dedication. The Casey case of long distance dedication. I love it. But
so basically, yeah, what's the dynamic? How do you, you know, what is it like to, you know, certainly the Spider-Man Mary Jane dynamic's the most obvious, and that's why I avoided that in the title. The Alicia mentioned is Alicia Masters, daughter of the Puppet Master.
Which I just found out tonight was
the
daughter.
Yeah, I just found out earlier tonight.
I learned something every day. I learned something every day.
So basically, the dynamic of, you know, how do you, as a normal person like Alicia Masters or Steve Trevor, is the Steve that we're mentioning here, that we're invoking, you know, when your spouse, your girlfriend, boyfriend, fiance, lover, what have you, when they're answering the call of duty, as it were, at all hours of the day and night.
Right. And I think that to start with, you know, the two aforementioned characters, Steve Trevor to me is a really interesting, they're both really interesting kind of dynamics. Because the one thing that occurred to me, even the last 5 minutes, is that Steve Trevor was almost the catalyst for Wonder Woman's superhero career. If I'm not mistaken, in certain continuities.
Yeah, in a way, I think almost in all of them, because he is sort of the guy who comes along and gets her off the island.
Right, right.
I mean, it's exactly what they were looking for. On Gilligan's Island, was for someone to come along and get them off the island, and that's
what Steve Trevor did. Steve Trevor also, luckiest man alive. Just period. Not like Cole was saying prior to this, not only did he survive what should have been a devastating, was it an experimental plane that he crashed in?
I don't remember. Or it was just like he was shot down, or it had engine failure.
Yeah.
Any the, you know, however planes crash. But yeah,
that's another show.
Yeah. But whatever reason, he was out effectively in the middle of nowhere, as good as dead.
Right.
And being apparently the luckiest man in the world, not only didn't land in the ocean, but landed on the island of nothing, but it was like reverse Smurfette.
He was the male version of Smurfette. He crash lands. The chances of him crash landing on any landmass are infinitesimal. Like, they just don't exist out there. But he manages it. Manages to crash land on an island and survive the crash. And sorry guys, got a cold. And not only that, but lands on the island of the most beautiful, powerful women that you could possibly imagine, the Amazons. The island of Themyscira, I believe, is the pronunciation of that island.
It's actually Maybelline's new mascara. It's like
The mascara. There's billboards all over. But yeah, him landing there was the catalyst for Wonder Woman, Princess Diana, to leave the island and enter the world of man.
Well, not only is he a catalyst, he's like the worst. He's like this virus that comes and infects the island.
Right, he's an invasive
species.
Because
up to that point, she's relatively, and granted, she was like, depending on the continuity, like sort of, like it's oddly enough, in a strange connection to Alicia Masters' father, or Alicia Masters herself, rather, you know, mom just made like a clay baby in some sort of Pinocchio story, and then the god said, you know, that is so pathetic. This is hard to watch. I'll tell you what, poof, little girl.
In a weird reverse Scarlet Witchy and twins.
Yes, exactly.
Right, like made a weird clay baby and then willed it to life. Like, just what? What? But regardless, she came to life, you know, and instantly mom was like, I can't believe I made that clay baby, because she was bucking the system from the jump. You know, like, I want to get off. I don't understand why we're on this island. Why are we doing this? You know, I don't want to shoot a bow and arrow. But she decided, because of Steve Trevor's, you know, invasive species nature, to enter the world of man and become their ambassador, as it were, and, you know, general ass kicker to the world. But where does that leave Steve Trevor? You know, Steve Trevor, national badass.
Yeah, I mean, he was like the shit. Okay, back in the, I think he was in the Air Force or the Navy, one of the two.
Right,
I forget. We'll just, you know.
But he was Special Forces decorated.
Yeah, and he was like the guy that, you know, if you wanted to put him in, it may have been an experimental plane, or it may have been like his own private plane, like, you know, the armed services grant you your own plane.
Right,
because
your license
you are
to kill.
The badass. But I don't know why the representative of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would have this weird sort of Catherine Hepburn. I remember when Steve was just recruited.
Oh,
I mean, they were sort of slipping into, like, Willow.
You kind of walked a thin line between Willow and Jimmy Stewart there. It was a real finite line. That was good. Oh, Cole, what would I do without you?
I know. But, yeah, you know, here he is always shown in the spotlight.
Right.
And in a way, it's this weird, I mean, Wonder Woman was created by a male feminist, you know, someone who was a man but very much backing the feminist movement, the feminist idea.
Right.
Or the ideals, and created this character as sort of a showcase of the powerful female character who got kidnapped and tied up a lot. But
right. He had a little kink. He had a little kink. Also invented the lie detector, but he had a little kink to him.
Yeah, well, he probably invented the lie detector so he could, you know, ferret out naughty lies.
Oh, God. But, yeah, like, so where does that leave Steve Trevor at the end of the day? He leaves what is essentially the U.S. You know, he leaves the world, this macho badass, and comes back as what is essentially arm candy for the most for the most powerful woman ever to have existed to mankind.
Well, the thing is, that does bring up an interesting point. What if, you know, our Steve Trevor, all-American pilot, was a bit of a mud fence, he'd still have wound up with Wonder Woman.
Right.
Because it's sort of like, you know, some sort of weird love potion thing where, you know, he was the first guy she'd ever seen. His mere presence had her acting out and, like, secretly. Okay, on an island of women where, you know, there's only a finite number of them.
Right.
Her showing up as the masked warrior when a mere head count, I mean, you don't need, like, Rain Man there to figure out. Definitely counting Amazons.
definitely counting Amazons.
It's like right up there with that Batman in the Garden of Eden.
When did that happen?
Oh, was that that like wasn't the thing like Secret Origins or something?
Oh,
like,
my God!
Forget that special that got pulled because of baby Clark Kent in the microwave thing.
Yes, yes, yes. But yeah, so you know, does Steve Trevor then, like, how does that affect his character? You know, how does it, and I don't mean his character as a comic book character, but how does that affect his character as a person? You know, you were born into this idea that you are, you know, that you are the badass, and then you come back and you bring with you what is the most powerful being at that point, short of, you know, Superman, to exist. So how does that play out for you? Like, do you then just play, you know, how does your home life, do you just play second fiddle? Do you step up your game? Do you support? Do you not support? Does it lead to schisms? You know,
do you wind up like just going out and like, fine, I'll just go fly my plane that weird sounding Joint Chiefs of Staff guy gave me?
Right, like what does that mean?
Yeah, you go do that, honey, because it's crashed all over my home island.
Right.
Call you ever going and cleaning up after yourself.
Now, in the new 52, they are not together.
Ah, okay.
The same idea, I think, is what transpired to get them, but he is a like sort of like an Argus, like cape killer type of guy. So they kind of turned that on its head, but originally that's what went down. And the other side of that, like you were saying, is the Alicia Masters idea, which is another really interesting perspective on the idea of a superhero non-powered relationship, which because you know, and much like we talked about in the comic book narrative, you try to tackle these ideas through you know, metaphor and simile and analogs. The Alicia Masters is blind.
Yeah, exactly. And it's blind. She's, the thing about it is that I think what underscores the nature there, and it's what's neat with her relationship with Ben is he has to constantly remind himself that she's blind, but she's not like numb,
right?
So it's sort of like, you know, sometimes he'll kind of go out on Yancey Street and get tomatoes and eggs thrown at him by the Yancey Street gang, and you know, be moping around about you know, and then it slowly begins to sink in. Well, oh yeah, because she's. She has to like come and be all touchy-feely and has made a career out of making sculptures in my rocky ass. And yet she's still, you know... she's not only, you know, a very courageous woman to, you know, follow her dreams and rise above her lineage.
Right.
But she also is courageous in that, you know... She invites Ben over, you know, like to sleep over and stuff.
that's true.
You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, if you had like a giant, like if you had like one of those Weebles, but it was made of iron and weighed 5,000 pounds. And, you know, like say the A-train keeps coming by at night and wobbling it. It may not fall down, but it could still, you know, you could break your hip.
You're on the metaphor A-train tonight.
I tell you, it's so true. Yeah, and oddly enough, I haven't really given this enough thought to overthink it. I'm just kind of like doing stunt
overthinking. Just go for it.
Yeah,
just go for it. And you know, there's this idea like we were saying with Spider-Man, you know. Part of entering into a relationship with a superhero, it's like, and we've spoken to this before, it's like getting in, it's like marrying a cop or marrying a firefighter, you know, if you know that they're a superhero, every time they leave the house, you have to wonder if they're going to come back. Every time you leave the house, there's that constant fear inside of you. And even if you don't know that they're a superhero, at that point, you are constantly in harm's way and don't know why. Like, that's the thing that gets me, is like if you're Gwen Stacy or Mary Jane or Lois Lane before she knew that Clark Kent was Superman, you're constantly in harm's way and have no idea why. It has to be the most horrifying, confusing thing in the world to live in that state. Just the Green Goblin's constantly like trying to grab you and fly off with you, and you have no idea why.
Yes.
You're just a person. You know, Lex Luthor is constantly, or the Banshee, or the, you know, the Royal Flush Gang, or
it's
whoever.
It's like being married to or related to Liam Neeson in the Taken. You know, you may not be the first one they grab, but you're gonna get grabbed.
Right, right. It might happen in the third or fourth sequel, but trust me, it's gonna happen. And that has to be taxing to never know why. Like, why is this happening to me? Like, do you have any thoughts on that besides the Liam Neeson thought, which was very salient,
yeah,
by the way?
Well, the thing about it is, as much as the comics try to be as realistic as possible, it's very rare that you get that. I mean, you know, Mary Jane and Peter Parker, and part of the reason this is titled the way it is I was trying to avoid that being like, you know, Mary Jane and Peter Parker, you know, that
right.
Like the only thing we're going to talk about. But you do come back to that because it is the signature such relationship. It is the longest lasting. And you do have the occasional, for, oh, where is Peter now? You know, he's been gone for a month. But I know he's Spider-Man. But you never really get the sense that, you know, the gut level anxiety.
Right.
Both from where are you and, you know, when is the Rhino going to come and knocking at the door? When are the villains going to come and wreak havoc? And what are the chances? Because it's about, I think right now, if you look at the history of the superhero wedding, it's about 50-50 that you get a villain attack.
Oh, yeah. It's an easy. Well, I think it's more 60-40 than 50-50.
Yeah, it's actually the chances of rain are slightly less than villain attack.
And the other side, too. So here's, and I'm sure that I'm missing some of these, but there's enough of it that I know that I'm not missing, you know, there should be more, let's put it that way, of the other side of that, which is when you're, you know, Spider-Man, or when you're whoever it might be that's in a relationship with a non-powered person, and you're out on patrol, or you are captured by the Skrull, or you are, you know, the Brood are attacking, or whatever it is, that you're not worried that you know, about them, or when you're going to get back to them. You don't see a lot of soliloquy, or, you know, giving the note to your to Tom Hanks to say, take this to my wife if I shouldn't make it out of this battle. You're just, oh, time to fight the masters of evil, and maybe,
yeah,
if
exactly.
I get back home, then I get back home. Who cares? Like, you don't see a lot of that happening. And I think that's a shame. I think that's a missed opportunity for them to be like, you know, I'm getting ready to go into what is probably, possibly going to be the end of me. And in that respect, I should probably take a moment to reflect or reach out to, like, another one that we haven't talked about, and I don't think it's come up in any of my research, is the relationship between Professor X and Moira McTaggart.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a...
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, is almost inevitable, because they're both, like, brainy professorial types. They're both in sciences and in mutants.
Yeah, but Moira wasn't a mutant, correct? She was just...
Oh, she just studied them.
Yeah, she was just the expert on mutants.
She was, like, you know, always a bridesmaid, never a mutant.
But you never see...
Never a mutant. But she did, you know, she was seeking to understand and was one of those humans who was part of the, you know, let's not have this mutie madness bullshit.
Right, but what you never saw was Professor X wheeling up to try to do battle with... To try to do battle with Magneto, and taking the literal split second it would take to reach across the Great Divide to her with his mind and say, "Hey, I just want to let you know that if I don't make it out of this, I love you, and I want you to know that, you know, you're always with me," and blah blah blah, and then go do battle. It would literally take a second for him to transmit that thought, but he never does it.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't ever occur to him. And nor has he ever, like set up a psychic link between him and Noria, so she could be like, Charlie, you might want to get your X-Men over here. My son has turned into a god.
Right.
Hey, Noria, holy crap, what happened here?
A Protean mutant island. Can you handle this for me? I think, sort of, with a few exceptions, that superheroes are kind of assholes. They're a little full of themselves and don't think about too many people outside of the current situation that they're in. I'm going to go on that. I'm going to stand by that right there.
Yeah. That's a good approach. But yeah, there is this sort of again, it comes down to how these characters are written, but there is this almost dismissive quality. It's almost like in a way, it's almost an indictment on relationship dynamics that can occur.
Yeah.
Where someone is so career-minded or full of themselves or what have you, or even just inadvertently so, that the relationship somewhere gets lost in the shuffle. And it's a big deck there that's shuffling around constantly when you're talking about a superhero. And, oh gosh, who was I thinking of? Oh, but like, and then there's sort of like the accidental superhero, like, what's her name from the Alpha Flight? Hudson's wife.
Because
she just sort of, she didn't really marry a superhero, she married a guy who became a superhero.
Right, and then she in turn became a superhero when he was no longer a superhero. But no, you're absolutely right, she became the sort of mama bear to Alpha Flight by proxy, which is a whole nother situation that you've got to wonder about. Like you obviously, that is love right there, ladies and gentlemen. You did not sign on to have a Sasquatch, giant robot, merwoman, shaman, Canadian god lady, you know, living in what essentially was your house.
Well, coming crashing in your apartment.
Right.
You know, especially because depending on the season, Walter Lankowski, I mean, God bless him, you know, he's got the superhero action going on, and, but, you know, deer ticks.
Deer ticks.
Yeah, I mean, when you're a Canadian superhero who's that furry, deer ticks.
Not only do we have to consider his Belushi-esque attitude, but we also have to consider his deer ticks. You know, and I think that the big one that we have to, you know, that we have to look at when we're talking about harm's way is you're probably going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just face facts. If you are a non-powered, even if you're powered, but even more so if you're a non-powered, you know, spouse of some sort.
Yeah.
You're probably going to die. You know, a few luminaries in this category, the unfortunate case of Sue Dibney, who...
I was going to invoke Sue Dibney on the opposite side of this.
But yeah.
In the superhero /normal pairing that really worked.
Yeah, well, it absolutely does.
And it was one of those things that dynamic with Ralph and Sue has been around a long time, but I kind of just fell into it. That, you know, I started reading, I don't know, like some Justice League. I think they were doing like the Justice League Europe thing where they kind of brought them, rebooted them. And the timing was such, at least for me, you know, I started reading that and I absolutely fall in love with Sue Dibney. And then
Identity Crisis hits.
Yes.
But the thing is, absolutely works. That's one of those comic book couples. Unlike, let's say, Hank Pym and Janet Van Dyne or Reed and Sue Richards, that you can read without cringing.
Yes!
You can read, and it actually brings a smile to your face. It's a Norman Rockwell, real, honest to God, written as a loving relationship. No, that you don't need to retcon their relationship to make it work. It just works, and it makes you happy. It's like watching Newhart. You know, it just fills your heart to the microcockles with joy.
Yeah, and I think that what was brilliant is if you happened upon that, you couldn't help but fall in love with Sue, which made it. Her fate all the more tragic.
Right.
But there is that tragic fate aspect, that sort of Gwen Stacy syndrome.
But you know what's really interesting about her death? And spoiler alert, okay, we're going to talk about Identity Crisis. If you haven't read it, stop this podcast now. Go read it.
Yeah, come back.
It's gotten mixed reviews, but Cole and I both support it. It's rough. There are some rough parts. Just understand that. But the fact that she did not die it's the peripheral cost of dating or being in love with or being married to a superhero. You know, it's that weird Miracle Man, Big Barda, boom tube in your living room cost of being married, because she didn't die in a giant battle. She wasn't collateral damage in a dark side fight. She didn't, you know, she didn't die because the mirror master sucked her into a parallel universe and she, you know, suffocated. She died in an accident.
Yes, exactly.
A super-powered accident. And not like, what was it, the new warrior starting the Civil War type accident. Like, commonplace, like slipping in the shower sort of accident. But it was caused because of superpowers.
Yes, exactly.
And that is the most tragic part, is that it wasn't this great harrowing event where she could be lauded as this hero. It was almost, by the end of it, it was almost a footnote how she actually died. And that was equally as heartbreaking, because you see this just, the destruction of Ralph Dibny throughout the course of this thing.
In fact, that her death ultimately, it serves a purpose, it drives this story very heavily. But you find yourself saying, you know, at what cost this story? And the most compelling stories are the ones where the writer is willing to effectively lose their children, as it were. You have to be willing.
And on the flip side, you know, now that you've read Identity Crisis, or have read it, and I'm not spoiling anything, that's another warning. Jean Loring, her fate as the wife of the Atom, also her fate as the accidental murderer of Sue Dibny. You know, that's equally as heartbreaking. Because, again, it was an accident as to what transpired. And she didn't really have any control over what happened. I mean, she did, but she didn't. And her life is destroyed as well. And with that, the life of the Atom. You know, that's another... I mean, this Identity Crisis really works on a lot of levels. And there's this argument out there that it harkens back to the women in Fridge issue that they've identified now as this idea of using the death, the abuse, the however you want to do it, of certain female characters to push stories forward. That's
one
of the...
Yeah, and very often... it's hard to say, to pinpoint or even really say in any distinct way, is it worse when they're non-powered?
Right.
Or should we be making a distinction if, a superhero couple or the superhero of a superhero / normal couple meets their demise, as happened, like, say, in Alpha Flight, where Guardian was destroyed.
Right.
Was blowed up. He blowed up real good.
Straight blowed up good.
Blowed up like he'd on Farm Film Celebrity Blow Up.
Jesus.
Only SCTV fans will understand.
Yes.
The invocation of Big Jim McBob and Billy Saul Yurick.
You're going to the well tonight, man. I love it. But yes, that's the question, is Identity Crisis, I think, works. Yes, it has that level to it. It is rough. There, you can look at it on the surface as, you know, that, as the women in Fridge, you know, exploitation for purposes of moving plot forward. But it works on a lot of different levels.
Well, it actually does. It works in the way that anything that appreciatively moves the plot, but without, you know, kind of being pandering or self-serving, because Sue becomes the kind of the unfortunate caught in the crossfire.
Right.
But in a sensible kind of way. And, it's not like just completely out of the blue or blatant or it works in a sensible way as part of the plot. It's not just a plot device to move a plot forward or to be provocative of confrontation. That's one of the things that, like, the girlfriend in the fridge is just a provocative move. It's to provide it. It becomes like Seven, basically.
Right, right.
Where it's all just this. The sole purpose of any aspect of the plot is just to move.
It's a plot. It's essentially a plot device at that point. It serves no further purpose to the story but to move the story.
Exactly.
Versus having some sort of weight, some sort of, you know, overarching archetypal weight to it that's going to resonate.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. The idea of Major Force shoving Alex DeWitt, who is Kyle Rayner's girlfriend, in the fridge, sort of as a way of saying, you're in the big leagues now, Green Lantern, and time to step up your game, was really only served as a plot device. It held no weight outside of the shock value of what it was.
Well, exactly, and you know, you're probably more familiar with what was going on. The stories I know of Major Force because it was a kind of spun out of when DC was starting to do something with Captain Atom.
Right.
But I really don't. I have only a passing familiarity during that period, and I know, you know, he's supposed to be sort of a jerk anyway. But at what point did, you know, literally, did we see this coming? Was there anything where the transverse of that is in Identity Crisis? You don't see it coming, but through the course of the story, you're given, you know, why it came, you know, came to pass, as it were.
Right, and the great thing, and I know this isn't Identity Crisis cast, but it's slowly morphing into that.
Yes.
What the cool thing about Identity Crisis is that you put a bunch of superheroes in a vacuum, and what do they do when one of their own is violated and ultimately killed? They go looking for themselves. But in the superhero world, and I think this applies to this story, when you're looking, when something like that happens and you go looking, you end up, and not to you know, get too parabolic, but you end up looking for zebras. So what they did, instead of looking for horses, is look for zebras. They went after supervillains. You know, they got a list of most likely suspects in order. Instead of saying, could this just be an accident? Could this be something, you know, superpowered but mundane? We're going to go after Dr. Light because of this history that he has, and it brought up all these other things that happened, but we won't get into, because that would be spoiling something that is really kind of shocking in a good M. Night Shyamalan, in a Sixth Sense M. Night Shyamalan sort of way, not in a Village M. Night Shyamalan sort of way.
Hey,
I like the Village.
Lady in the Water.
Lady in the Water. The devil elevator movie. But they went looking for zebras instead of horses, and that's what happens. That's, I think, another downfall of being in a relationship, or being in love with, or being married to, or having a passing fancy with somebody with superpowers, is they don't look at the world the same way you do, because they can't. Because of the situations they're put in on a daily basis, they cannot see the forest for the trees, or the molecules for the atmosphere, you know?
Well, because they've been so far removed on a daily basis.
Right.
From pretty much all of the in many cases, all of the concerns of mortal man, or at least, you know, have so much on their plate that's outside of the norm, the day-to-day.
Right. Well, it's like, so, you know, what's wrong with turning into a weird eagle and flying into a woman's window and impregnating her and having her give birth to Perseus? What's wrong with that? I'm Zeus. Who cares? You know, that's just, it's, you're so far, you know, ice station zebra, Kleenex boxes on your feet.
But nobody really asked what she, you know, thought about.
Right,
having to raise this demigod child, or
right,
you know, having to live with the, if nothing else, the secret shame of having to go around and with an illegitimate child that she you know, was it a good idea? Was it in bad taste to admit it was the gods that...
Right, this Olympian eagle baby that I've had to...
Seduced you, you know, well, it's kind of out.
I
was out on the town, and this shower of gold walked up to me in the bar, and, you know, when am I going to meet a shower of gold again?
Well, and you get some of that, and here we go. Are you ready? Are you buckled in, Cole? Because you get some of that with the Dr. Manhattan Silk Spectre relationship.
I was actually beginning to head that direction, but because it is a deep well that is drawn from often, I was holding back a bit.
That door's open. That door's always open to you, Cole. So the infinite mansion has one door that says the watchman that you're always welcome in.
Yeah.
You're always welcome in the House of the Undying, Cole. Not that Game of Thrones you, but there you go. It has pangs of this idea that sometimes, as a human being, you want to order Chinese food and watch Netflix. You don't want to hop on a guy's back and fly to China and then watch every movie in existence in the span of a second. You know,
that's right. And not only fly to China, but to have authentic Chinese food and find out, you know, I'm just... call me bad, but I'm kind of used to the crappy American stuff.
Right, exactly.
You know, I appreciate the authenticity here, but, you know...
Right.
They have any kind of like, you know, chow mein?
Well, I imagine it's the same issue that people have, you know, with the ultra rich. You know, the people that are so far removed from society that they are omega rich, you know, Dubai rich, Bill Gates rich, where you don't have to worry about the common mundanity of life. And I'll tell you something, the common mundanity of life has a certain appeal to it that you don't realize is there until it's not there anymore. And that's another a factor. But we're getting long in the tooth, and the show's coming about the end, and there's one relationship that I want Cole to discuss a little further, if not the Dr. Manhattan Silk Spectre conversation, which I'm sure that he does. But that would be one that's come up quite a few times on the show, and that is... the love affair between Dr. Alan Holland or Dr. Alec Holland and Abigail Arcane. Again, another daughter of a supervillain.
Absolutely, and what's becomes even more fascinating with that is that through the process of that very unique relationship, which, you know, is by far amongst the most unique ever.
Right.
You do have, in a way, it's almost like the Thing and Alicia Masters, because you do have the daughter of a principal villain who is rising above her lineage.
Right.
While simultaneously having to live it down, who is... not, you know, beyond enamored, is actually, you know, madly in love with a human trapped in this inhuman body.
Right.
And then you take that dynamic a step further, and she is in love. I think ultimately she is never stops. The dynamic never changes from her being in love with Alec Holland.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that's easy to miss there, is that she is madly in love with Alec Holland, and Alec Holland is effectively a dead man. She is in love with a memory of Alec Holland.
Right.
That she got to meet. So the discovery, the revelation that, you know, it isn't Alec Holland after all, doesn't change anything.
No.
Because, you know, it's still the aspects of him that, you know, are very much
a part of Swamp Thing.
Yeah, even though it's not really him, it is still him in a sense. So this entity has also taken on the personality. So in many ways, it's to have a super slash super relationship. It is the very much the Vision Scarlet Witch kind of thing.
Right.
Even though this construct is an artifice of another man's personality traits, or other men, or other robots, I'm not really sure.
Whatever they are now, yeah.
But, you know, the thing about it is that ultimately, I think that's one of the most compelling of the love stories, because it is, you know, it transcends even the thing Alicia.
Right.
Dynamic, because there's at least, it's still Ben Grimm in there.
Right. This is literally almost like a golem-esque soul inside of a plant creature that is an avatar for, you know, this magical realm, essentially.
Yeah.
That she continues to be in love with, because it embodies what Alec Holland was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's and nobody could have pulled it off except for the guy that managed to reinvent Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
And if you want to learn more about that guy, go listen to 5 issues on him that we did.
Yeah, that's right. We just couldn't shut up. So,
but in a lot of, you know, here's an interesting one that we haven't talked about that I kind of wanted to touch on earlier that didn't come up in any of my research, but just dawned on me at the beginning of recording, and that is Jane Foster and Thor.
Ah, yes, indeed.
Because everybody we've talked about, even Swamp Thing, we aren't talking about gods here. We're talking about people with powers.
Yeah.
You know, Jane Foster and Thor fell in love. Thor is a god. He's a Norse god. That is very much the Zeus, you know, the Olympian gods coming to Earth and you know, prancing around with you know, mortal women scenario. But if you read the comic, and if you you know, it's alluded to in the movies, but especially in the comics, Jane Foster kind of runs that relationship.
So it's sort of like an FML.
It's
FLR. I'm sorry, that was the
which stands for
female led relationship. I recently stumbled on that.
Wow. But okay.
Every now and again, I'll find these anagrams. Like, what the hell is that?
That's pretty much every. My life right there. But that's a really interesting dynamic in a world, and this is from pretty much the beginning, in a world that's been dominated, you know, by this masculo hierarchy of superpowered men, to have a relationship where a Norse god is being put in its place, almost, you know, put in its place by a fully human nurse, doctor, depending on how far
in
it is.
In a sense, what you also, you get a similar kind of dynamic, of course, with the Abby Swamp Thing, because he ultimately, you have this revelation of him being akin to a god.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is literally this force of nature walking around in a skin of sorts.
Right. But that one struck me as interesting because of that dynamic. One I wanted to touch on, and Cole and I had talked about this earlier, but as the show winds down, and it is a super, super relationship. It is a super slash relationship.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it before, and I think it was, I don't remember which issue it was, but during the Civil War, before the Civil War, you had the marriage of Black Panther and Storm, which was this idea that you know, almost this not even just like super couple, Reed Richards, Sue Richards getting married, but it was like joining two worlds. You had Wakanda, you had the mutant, you know, the kind of mutant civilization coming together, and they were very much in love, and it was written really well. Then the Civil War hit, and you find Black Panther and Storm on opposite sides of the Civil War. And I had talked about it earlier, how great it was to see the dynamic. And then I started thinking about it. What they really did, if you want to see the story of what happens when they're a story of irreconcilable difference. And that's what they did so well against a backdrop of this superhero registration act, superhero versus superhero, the death of Goliath, you know, this the coming of the death of Captain America, all of this culmination of things was the backdrop to this love story that was dissolved because of the schism. And you get to see it play out in the issues of Black Panther Civil War, this comic book, this beautiful coming apart and rending because of this situation that they cannot resolve. It is bigger than they are. It is an ideological divide. And they end up duking it out at the end because, you know, it's a superhero comic. They've got
it. Naturally, you got to
duke it out. But it was very, very and it took me a long time to put my finger on why it was so emotional when you know, it was very much on the surface just the story of the Civil War, just another chapter. And the reality is that's what happened. You get to see this couple that you've come to really care about in the comics because they were very much the workaday couple. It would be like a cop husband and wife that go out and then come back and talk about their days. We talked about that in the earlier show. But what happens as it dissolves? You know, what happens as it erodes because of this greater thing that happens? And I think it happens to a lot of relationships, and they do a really good job of encapsulating that against this backdrop. So I wanted to put that out there. If you haven't read it, please read it. It's actually really, really good. So that's what I got to say about that. So
no, I think that's also a very good point because it's rare you get into the really in-depth of relationships.
Right.
Like that. And are able to delve so deeply into, you know, sometimes the professional differences that can come in for superheroes are not unlike the, you know, religious or political or other ideological differences that can create that kind of rift in a marriage or other relationship.
Right. Now, are there any other ones that you want to touch on before we... You wanted to talk about Donna Troy and Terry Long.
Yeah, definitely Donna Troy and Terry Long, because that was one of the best interwoven such tales along these lines, where you have the super and non-super characters kind of coming together, and I think he was like a teacher or something, or university professor or something, and he's sort of like talking about, you know, walking in Steve Trevor's footsteps. It gets to be like this super lucky guy who somehow starts a relationship with a superhero, and you get to see the development of their relationship, of the characters themselves, and just this really neat love story that touches the lives of all of the other Titans in many ways. And so you get this very layered tale of, you know, bringing these people together and in ways you don't normally get.
Right.
The comics, and I think that was what was so neat, and it did culminate in probably one of the best superhero weddings ever, because it wasn't, you know, there was no need to have the villains attack and disrupt things. There was no need to effectively do anything to mess around with the story. It was a well-crafted tale that led to a great wedding, and what was fun with that is then you had the superheroes kind of taking a breather for a change and being able to, you know, it explored the dynamic of these friends who are a team.
Right, and I think you were talking about Gar at that wedding.
Because Garfield, Logan, Beast Boy at the time, or Changeling at the time, former Beast Boy, future Beast Boy, odd, but they, you know, he was sort of the one, he's the wisecracker, the the one who isn't taking everything all that seriously. So he was often marginalized by the Titans, and especially by the you know, the guy who was kind of like the Alfred to Mento.
Oh, Mento.
Yeah, you know, because he was living on the estate like some sort of Cato Kalin.
Wow.
Yeah, like this lime
Did
green.
Did you just Cato climb Kalin. Into the white Bronco and take us to Cato yep. Kalin land?
You've been juiced.
Jesus.
Yes, I invoke that. I think I invoked that on the Rancor Pit, actually. I don't think it was on this show, but I actually brought up a thing of this one-shot gag, like, candid camera type thing that apparently after the big high-profile trial that O.J. Simpson was in.
Wow.
It was, like, punked with O.J.
With O.J.?
Yeah, look it up. Apparently, I heard this whole... expose on it on the radio, and it sounds like the most god-awful. But anyway, it was... so you have this... these well-established characters, and they all of them are in character throughout. And, you know, all of a sudden this guy dressed as a clown shows up, and there's this sort of, like, oh, what has he done now moment. And Gar explains that, you know, he's showing that he is, when he take, you know, when he's not compensating.
Right.
He is actually a very thoughtful person. He's hired this clown in to entertain the kids who've been drugged along to this boring-ass wedding. Because he's still close enough to that end. You know, he's the most teen of the Teen Titans.
Right, he understands it, right.
He knows, he remembers well what it's like to be a kid, and especially a kid in his position who's been drugged all over the place to things. You know, he's been to more gala luncheons than you've had hot meals, but he... So, it was just this wonderful dynamic, and the wedding goes off without a hitch, and it's tied into the, unfortunately... post 52 irrelevant Donna Troy story where you know, they even tied that into the wedding in a sense that Robin gets to play detective and figure out Donna Troy's official origin,
right,
and couches that as a wedding gift to the couple,
right. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it was just, there were so many elements about that, but it was all about the human superhero element done right. But again, as we talked about, I think the underlying theme here is that out of just the necessity of things, nobody ever is able to truly, you know, get all of those aspects of the dynamic in there. You don't get to, I think one of the things is at least seemingly lacking in what experience I've had with this type of storyline is that that kind of schism you were talking about with Storm and Black Panther.
Yes.
That would occur just from the, you know, the hard work of the career spouse.
Right.
Or, you know, that dynamic where, you know, especially what I would love to see is the unspoken angst.
Right.
Because to me, that is more real than every fifth issue bitching about, you know, how you're, you know, I understand you're a hero, and, you know, sometimes you need to be my hero, and, you know, all that sort of thing. I would rather see the fostering of resentment, the quiet,
yeah,
tongue-biting fostering of resentment to the point where it just boils over, because to me that's more what the reality would be. Because imagine the level of guilt a Lois Lane,
right,
or a Terry feel about feeling that they're playing second Madonna to the entire world
and not being able to say anything.
Yeah, but, you know, do you say anything?
Right.
Because, you know, do you have the right to put yourself in front of the rest of the world?
Exactly.
Especially if you knew you were getting into it in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's... so that's, you know, every now and again I'll get in this sort of admonition kind of bent where I'm hoping that perhaps, you know, we'll see someone, you know, sort of bringing out the things I'd love to see happen.
Right. And hopefully we will.
I mean, I would love to see that sort of thing happen. It's hard to get all the things we'd love to see into a
into a comic, right? Those are our dreams. Like, a lot of people are like, they want to see Superman fight the Hulk. We just want to see some honesty, damn it. Some transparency. Is that so much to ask?
Exactly.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. I think we've done it justice.
We have indeed. We've truly given this everything. We've given it the kind of attention that busy superheroes and superheroines don't give their spouses.
No.
But we did forget a couple that before the show you had brought up, and I think we would be remiss to simply go away without talking about a very special couple.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Who I think was a couple we never knew was a couple. I talked about before the show. It's like four weddings and a funeral.
Right.
And not solely because, actually or apparently, it's some sort of a homosexual relationship.
But it's not. But is it?
Yeah, because it kind of becomes that Swamp Thing kind of transcendence.
Right, and of course we're talking about Mala and the Brain. Mala,
yes.
Being a giant, intelligent
Monsieur Mala,
the giant intelligent
French gorilla,
and the Brain in the Jar. Probably the weirdest comic book relationship out there. And we're talking about comic books here. There's a lot of weird-ass relationships. This one, by far, the weirdest. It doesn't matter what sex they are at that point, because we're talking about a giant gorilla and a brain in a jar. Talk about overcoming, you know, societal hurdles. Giant talking gorilla, brain in a jar. I think they deserve the Lifetime Achievement Award for courage in comic books, frankly.
Absolutely. because they dared to dream the impossible dream.
And lived it.
Yes, and nothing so defines the impossible dream as a brain in a robot body and a hyper-intelligent mutated gorilla.
That's true.
Who is apparently a Francophile.
Yeah, that damn beret says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, that and the, you know, taking on the epitaph. I always get confused with the word because I don't want to sound like the, you know, somebody's on their tombs.
Right, the epitaph, I think.
Epitaph, yeah. I think that's it. Or epaulettes.
Epaulettes, well, he did. I think he did
shoulders.
Have epaulettes.
He may have had epaulettes at one time. I did have a wicked bandolier that I think he got off of John Belushi's Killer Beak costume.
Second Belushi reference tonight.
Oh, that's so true. But you know, the it's obvious he fancies himself French, even though by his very nature, as a gorilla, a mountain gorilla, is African.
Right, he did not come from French.
He's an indigenous species. What's he going to do? He's a gorilla. But, you know, again, you know, live your dreams. you know, it's kind of like Rocky Horror. Don't dream it, be it.
Oh, God. Let's just wrap it up. I think we've done enough.
Yeah, we're now sort of moving outside the realms of justice.
We've gotten into the exhaustion that, you know, of you think darkness is your ally. You think darkness is your ally. Okay, so why don't you plug us up? We'll get out of here.
Yes, indeed. We were, of course, coming to you as always from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com, and which we will be very shortly renewing JediCole.com for a few more years because we're pretty much
married to it.
Yeah, that's there is nothing but the JediCole.com for me. And You can write to us, and please do, because we'd love to hear from you at jcumail@yahoo.com. Still putting out the occasional tweets on Twitter, @TheJediColU, which is, of course, universe, not to be confused with the Jedi Cult University, which we're working on that. Accreditation issues.
Funding.
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to mention the funding, but the accreditation issues are certainly there as well. Funding is part of it. But, look for us all over the place, different events and stuff coming up. We're trying to increase our presence for the Rancor Pit, for example. Eddie and I will be out doing some coverage of Force Friday, which would be have been earlier today as you listen to this. So there you have it. So you can, speaking of Eddie and the Rancor Pit, you can find the Rancor Pit live at deepelemonair.com, and you can check out the archive of the live version of this very show that ran for 10 months.
That's right.
And with that, I think we should part company. Let us get about the things we need to do in our people lives.
That's right. And you guys too. But join us next week. Next week for issue 150. And what's that going to be like?
What's that smell like? We're hoping what this will be, if we can pull this off. And we are going to be cutting it awful close. Is we're shooting for something we did in our first annual, so a long time ago there. We're hoping to revisit the best comic I ever read with a whole new slew of guests.
That's right.
And there we have it. We're hoping we can get all of our guest interviews put together in time. We may be running a little late on that one, but I think we should go for it.
Yeah, we should.
And we will we'll take things from there. So with
there
that,
go.
I think we're ready to...
Yeah, let's head off into this good night. So say good night, Cole.
Good night, everybody, and thank you.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for listening to what is 149 amazing issues of Making Comics. You guys are amazing. We'll talk to you next time.